This week, the precious metals staged an impressive rally on news that the People's Bank of China added to its gold stockpile. Well, hello everyone. Chris Waltzek. So good to be back with you this weekend. We have another big show lined up, including top guests and market commentary. Following weeks of selling, well, the yellow metal and silver rallied sharply, in part due to the dollar decline, as well as new purchases in China. But in the aftermath of a difficult few years here in the sector, when will the gold bulls regain the upper hand? Joining me with their outlooks on this sector, Dr. Stephen Lieb and John Williams. John Williams of Shadow Stats has dire comments on the domestic economy. He's convinced this is good news for gold investors and that the headline inflation number is understated by opaque statistical methods. He thinks a new recession is imminent and hyperinflation will send the metals higher. Then Dr. Lieb joins me in a discussion on gold. He thinks eventually China will have just such a stable reserve currency. When the monetary system eventually implodes, he says it'll free the shackles of bondage between the classes, and gold will regain its essential role as a must-have asset for everyone. And we'd like for you to record your questions and comments. We have a toll-free hotline, 1-206-6665-370. Just jot it down, if you like, on a post-it pad, or plug it right into your phone or iPhone. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. The show begins now with the market weather recap. Sunny skies appeared over the New York COMEX exchange this week as dollar weakness encouraged the metals bulls. The news sent gold higher, adding $20, finishing up at $11.13 an ounce. Silver picked up nearly half a dollar, up 3% on the week, finishing at $15.22 an ounce. The XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index added 1.8 points. That's 4% on the week, just shy of $50. And West Texas Intermediate crude oil gained nearly 10% on the week, finishing close to the $50 per barrel point. Gold posted the sharpest weekly rally in 2 months as investors picked up the safe haven metal amid unexpected currency carnage. China's yuan was devalued this week, increasing volatility in the currency's markets. Bullion rallied on dollar weakness, which added to the appeal of gold due to its wealth-preserving qualities. On Friday, the People's Bank of China announced its plans to increase bullion holdings by 54 million ounces, a gain of 1,600 tons. Interestingly, the PBOC only last month outlined its 50 increases since 2009, making it the fifth largest stockpile worldwide. The central bank is now offering greater transparency of gold reserve moves, still the world's largest producer and consumer of the metal. And here's the thinking process behind all of these big changes. Officials in China are trying to convince the IMF that the yuan is ready for inclusion as a reserve currency in that key basket, along with the U.S. dollar, the yen, the euro, and the British pound. Precious metals, bottom line. Signs of accumulation all across the boards this week led to a forceful short covering rally. The bulls were clearly encouraged by the PBOC's more regular purchase updates and dollar weakness. For all of next week's gold forecasts, plus our favorite stock candidates, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter early next week. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly sunny weather appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week. Investors returned from the sidelines on stronger than expected domestic economic reports. The Dow Jones Industrials Average did drop just a hair, down 0.6% at 17,477, only 104 points for the week. The S&P 500, though, bucked the trend, ending at 2091, up 14 points for the week, less than a percent. And the NASDAQ was up 5 points, less than 0.1%, ending near the break-even point at 50.48. Well, Wall Street cheered the oil rally on Friday. It was the best performance for black gold in 1 month. In addition, news of the large Berkshire Hathaway acquisition encouraged traders to increase position sizes across the board. Meanwhile, 465 companies on the S&P 500 have or will report solid earnings near expected levels, according to one media report. The S&P 500, though, is currently at an earnings per share reading of about 18.2 times earnings. That's well beyond the 10-year average of 15.7. That stretches valuation levels a bit to the extreme. One company that outlines blowout analyst earnings, though, Amazon.com, ticker AMZN, looks primed to fly even higher. The online retailer recently surpassed even Walmart as the biggest in its sector in the U.S. Amazon remains a favorite alpha stock candidate. Bottom line, Wall Street. Fear continues to move to excessive levels now, with the seven-component fear index floundering at record lows. Clearly, investors have tossed in the towel, and that's a sign that more savvy traders like to see near market bottoms. For next week's forecast, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. So good to be back with you with another GoldSeek.com radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's featured guest, Dr. Stephen Leeb. My featured guest today, Dr. Stephen Leeb, has over a quarter century of investment experience, author of seven books at least, and a number of bestsellers, The Oil Factor, The Coming Economic Collapse, Game Over, and Red Alert, and he's working on another one now on our favorite topic, gold. Welcome back, Dr. Leeb.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's always a pleasure.
It's great to have you back with us today. And we were talking before the show about the upcoming tome. Give us an idea, if you could, please.
I believe the world's shifting very much west to east, and China is becoming a very much more important player in the world than, I mean, most people realize China's become a very important player. But I think that if you tallied up the number of negative headlines on China versus the number of positive headlines, you'd probably find more negative headlines. People worried about, how much debt they have, is the economy going to implode, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that that's going to happen. I think that China is going to continue to grow. I think that by some measures, right now, China is the largest economy in the world, larger than ours, if you use purchasing power parity. But, there's some controversy as to whether that's a good way of measuring things or not. But it's certainly the case that if China continues to grow at a relatively rapid rate for China, let's say 7%, 6.5% to 7.5%, which I think is possible, they're going to pass us by every measure within the next, I would say, 5 years or so. So that it's a very, very big deal in the sense that China is a country that wants to control its own fate, basically wants to assure itself that it has trading partners, that it has a vibrant economy, that it can continue to provide the good life or increasingly better life for, its citizens.
But, that sounds intelligent to me, Doctor. I mean, they've been wise enough to install circuit breakers so they allow the good in. But, when there's something negative economic on the horizon or a trade pattern or idea that they're not comfortable with, they can sort of trip the breaker and protect their society from global problems.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very, very good point. Yes, it is a good point. They tend to, basically try and, get ahead of the curve rather than, react to it. I mean, the recent correction, sharp fall in their stock market, I think, was kind of an example of that. I mean, a market that goes down 35% in 6 or 7 weeks or however long it took is something to be worried about. But, there's a lot of countries that, might just kind of shrug their shoulders, but China really went in there and did something about it. I mean, as fast as they could. I mean, we've had markets in this country that have gone down. I mean, goodness, in 08, before we got around to doing anything about it, our market was down about 70%. And 08, 09, in 1973, 74, ditto, a 50% decline. And China, also, their stock market is not nearly as important to them as our market is to us. I mean, I think a relatively small portion of their populace really participates. But still, they stepped in front of it. What they did, I think, made some sort of sense. And, they stopped the problem before it really became large. And I think that this has been, how they've been operating. Right now, they're, initiating another infrastructure package. It's not going to be on the level of the one in 08, 09, 2009, but it will be targeted, and they have learned a lesson from what happened in 2009. I mean, you just don't give, banks running orders to lend to anybody and their uncle. You say you manage, I mean, you not manage, but you make sure that whomever is doing the lending is doing it to people that really need particular products and services, like water pipes, like subways, and stuff like this. I mean, China is still a very, very much an emerging economy. But, speaking of, what they're trying to do right for their people and their populace, if you look at internal measures of wealth in the country, you see that average per capita GDP has grown at an annualized rate of roughly 10% over the past, 5, 6, 10 years, whatever period you want to say. And right now their per capita GDP is up to around $13,000 in internal in terms of internal measurements, purchasing power parity. And it's nowhere near as high as ours, but given where they came from, it's getting there. And I think that they'll continue to focus on eliminating inequalities, or not completely eliminating it, but making them less. They'll focus on getting rid of corruption, very important, especially in the military area, and they'll focus on, basically, for lack of a better word, providing the good life for people. And that means it means that China doesn't want to be aggressive in the sense that it wants to, make sure everybody in the world is following a particular type of government. It really just wants to, wants to trade with people, wants to, sort of a win-win situation. But it does want a, a powerful military, because it wants to assure itself that it is not going to be bothered, and it's not going to be affected by, anything the U.S. or anybody else may want to do or may want to stop. And I think this is another argument for gold. I mean, not only China's desire to have a currency that stands at least on par with the dollar, if not more important, and that means a reserve currency. And one way of doing that, I think, would be to back their currency at least partially, or back a basket of currencies in which their currency is the major part, with gold. And that in itself will mean, much higher gold prices, because, there's not that much gold in the world. If you don't have enough gold to back your currency, there's only two ways you can go about doing it. You can either find more gold and there's not that much more to find, or the price of gold can go way up. I think it'll be the latter. And I think that, China, you've just seen this, not just to China, but all throughout the East, you've seen massive movements of gold from West to East. And I think that it's just a matter of when, not whether. And I think that, one situation that I have become aware of, Chris, which is really, frankly, alarming. I'm not a Chinophile. I'm an Americanphile. I love America. I think we're, a great, great country with all our freedoms and everything else. But I am just alarmed at our complacency, almost across the board. We are getting our heads handed to us when it comes to cybersecurity and issues like that. And even, in terms of hard military stuff, the U.S. right now basically is sitting in a position where they still believe, and I think with some validity, that they are clearly the number one country in the world, even though by some measures, as I mentioned, China may have surpassed us economically. But our military is supposedly second to none, and in many ways it is second to none. But there are some critical areas out there that we have to be very, very worried about. Cybersecurity. I mean, we're not as good as China. We're probably not even as good as Israel, which has 8 million people compared to our hundreds of millions, 300 million people that we have here. And that's a very, very serious lack. We should be king of cybersecurity. I mean, we've got the best universities in the world. But, our problem here is that the best and brightest don't go into these areas. In Israel, in China, they do. It's considered, high esteem. I mean, people that are, in these cyber cores in both Israel and China, and these are two countries that I know something about, are regarded with great, are very prestigious. I mean, this is one of the most prestigious things you can do in the country, in one of the leading cyber groups or cyber cash, whatever you want to call them, but they're eating our lunch and in this area. I mean, they just stole 20 million personnel records from our government. Anybody that has worked, that works for the U.S. government, and anyone that has gotten clearance for anything, whether it's low level or top secret, China knows you. China knows who you are. Not only do they know who you are, but for people that have gotten this clearance, they also know all the forms you filled out to get it. They know so much personal information. And you know where all this comes from? I mean, China's thinking on this. I would advise everybody to pick up this book that's 2,500 years old. I mean, not copy that's 2,500 years old. If you could find that, I would just hold on to it because it's going to be worth a fortune. But it's called The Art of War. A lot of what China does is right there. I mean, chapter 13 is a chapter on spies.
So Sun Tzu was a huge proponent of the importance of intelligence. In fact, he relied on it. That was really his key formula. And there's so much wisdom that I've just picked up over the years that I think is applicable to business, investing, life, relationships. It's really remarkable. Some of it is maybe counter to the belief system that we have here in the West. And I think that's where some of the resistance comes from. But it's a remarkably, you know, useful. For instance, I mean, you never enter a battle unless victory is assured. You avoid at all costs.
Yeah, that's a pretty good idea, right? I mean, seriously.
Well, we're not really reared that way in Western culture. We're like, you know, you stand tall and you take your licks and, you know, you plow forward. You know, even Patton pointed out, you know, let the other guy do that.
And if you don't have to fight a war, don't fight it. I mean, you know, there's no reason to fight a war, you know, unless it's your only choice. And if you're going to fight it, win it.
Doesn't just make military sense. I mean, it makes ethical sense, financial, economic. It's wisdom from the Art of War. And incidentally, for historians that are listening, they know that really there may not have been a specific general named Sun Tzu, likely attributed to several great leaders of the time. There's some debate, but what I find fascinating is there are some core tenets in that tome, and it's very easy. Anyone could pick it up and read it in the afternoon, you know, while watching TV. They're really profound and also need to gather the best information and knowledge in order to make these important key decisions. And that's one of the reasons why we like having you on the show, because while everyone else is shunning and poo-pooing China and other great cultures, claiming they're upstarts and taking over the world, I mean, what I want us to do is learn from these folks and embrace them as allies. And when I bring that up, the resistance is frightening.
I have to say that that's music to my ears. I was talking to actually a Chinese woman the other day who works in this country. Don't want to say her name, but, you know, and she was saying that, well, you like China, don't you? I mean, because I say, you know, good things about them. I said, well, you know, I'm an American, though. I mean, I am an American first, but yes, I do have a lot of respect for China, some of the things that they've done. But I said, my wish, my greatest wish, and we both agreed, is that China and America, they work together. You know, this is a, you know, we have a lot of poverty in this world and a lot of things that we could do together rather than, you know, oppose one another. I mean, you know, I think China, if this was done in the right way, and it might be a very long-term project because it's not going to change overnight our attitudes or maybe the Chinese attitudes. I mean, there's a lot of mistrust, let's face it. But I think that, you know, it just could be a great world if we could all work together. I mean, you know, I don't know whether this makes me sound un-American. I'm not trying to. I mean, I love America.
I think this equation just adds right up. For instance, instead of it maybe coming across as almost, as you say, un-American, it's far from it. In fact, and I don't think this is too far out in left field, that it is quintessentially American to A, respect your elders, B, be conservative and yet hardworking, have a strong ethic. We've stepped away from so many of these truisms that I think that they have embraced. China reminds me of the U.S. from what I've read, circa 1900.
But, you know, China's history, though, is one of not necessarily, you know, trying to take over other countries, but trying to, you know.
Yeah, let's talk about the Opium Wars. I mean, we're talking about a country that was literally decimated from the inside out, and then all of their ports blown away by an overwhelming military force that would be similar to giant alien ships coming down from outer space. This is a country that has not exactly had an open door policy for good reason.
And I would say, you know, I've done, obviously, I mean, hopefully, because I wrote a book on it. And, you know, it's going to be part of a major part of this book on gold. I've done a lot of reading on China, but I think the stuff that's really affected me the most, some of the fiction that I've read. And when you read the fiction and you see that basically what really, you know, resonates with China more than anything is that they don't want to be, you know, looked down upon. They don't want to be, they don't want to feel like they're dominated by other people. They want to be their own person. And I think that this is what they basically are fighting for right now. This means that they are much more focused on defending, avoiding war, but making sure if there is a war, they're going to prevail. I mean, it is the Sun Tzu kind of philosophy. And there's this wonderful parable. It's by, you know, I can't remember the author's name. He's one of the most popular, certainly wrote in the 20th century in China. But it does tell you something about the China, their civilization. The true story of AQ, A-H-Q, is a book written by Lu Xun, L-U, X-U-N, and Lu Xun was one of the most popular writers in China, and the story that really resonated with me, it was a metaphor about, you know, China being put down, China being, you know, embarrassed, and AQ was the name of somebody that, you know, basically was made to feel guilty for things he did not do, and but the moral message of the book is, there's no reason to be embarrassed. There's no reason to, you know, to have people telling you that you're wrong when you're not wrong, to be your own person. And I think that this book has really resonated with the Chinese, and it sort of tells you what China is after. I mean, that and Confucianism. I mean, you know, they have a civilization that goes back, about 16 out of the last 18 centuries. I think they've been the number one economy in the world.
If you have a society that is ruled by leaders who understand that every battle is won before it's even begun, this is a profound concept. I mean, how many business people do we know? Most people just roll the dice, don't they? They don't spend that much time contemplating for years on the next move, the next chess piece move.
They don't. I mean, we're a society that ever more has become driven by immediate gratification. You know, I may be dating myself, but when I grew up, I was taught it was a very good thing to save and to invest for the future. You know, right now, the future sometimes is measured in nanoseconds. This book, Flash Boys, by, you know, it's talking about getting a nanosecond jump on somebody else in trading. And all these algorithms that you see hedge funds employing are, again, getting nanosecond jumps in trading. This is not the way you build a future for, you know, the 21st century. And China basically, you know, lays out plans that it thinks it can live up to and, you know, tries to go about doing it. But one thing, Chris, which I don't think people realize, I mean, people tend to call it a communist state. They're not communists at all. I mean, most of China right now is driven by free enterprise. The state basically controls the banks. I mean, there are a lot of democracies in which the state controls the bank, I mean, the major banks, and they control some of the mining. They want to make sure that there's no exports of gold. They want all that gold that they mine to stay in China. But basically, the driving force in the Chinese economy are all these private enterprises. Like, you know, well, you read about Alibaba. I mean, you know, companies that emerge, whether they be miners. I mean, there are some miners that are private, a lot of them, in fact. Or whether they be internet companies or whether they be retailers, they're private. And that has been a major driving force in China, and it's one reason that they've been growing so rapidly, because a lot of these private owners and entrepreneurs have a longer-term vision. I mean, we don't have that long-term vision in this country anymore. I mean, and there's, you know, we've got to get that back. I mean, you know, this whole issue of cybersecurity, when I realized that China probably had an edge, it was another fiction book that I read called Decoded. And it was about how much esteem China placed on spies. And this book was, I think, written originally about 10 years ago. It was just published in America maybe 2 years ago. And it was written by a guy who's a very popular writer in China. But again, you know, one of the messages in the book, it's actually not a bad read. I mean, if anyone's interested, Decoded is the name. I'm not going to try and pronounce the name of the Chinese author. But it is Decoded. And it's, again, showing the prestige in which people that are very good spies are held. they're held very, very, they're held in the highest regard. And that's the message of Art of War. And that's one reason why I think China is really gaining on us.
Just sparked another idea here. We were talking earlier about our failure to understand our economic trading part. Let's call them partners and not opponents. Let's call them instead of enemies. And if we hearken back to Sun Tzu, I mean, this of course is almost a cliche now, but you know your enemy and know yourself. And not 100 conflicts will you lose. You'll always prevail. But what are we doing? We're not learning from our trading partners. If we do, we can gain synergies between that relationship. But by ignoring that wisdom that can be gleaned, it just breaks the communication, and we find ourselves back in the dark ages.
Right. No, exactly. I mean, we have to be, you know, much more willing to, you know, learn and to adopt and to, you know, stay within, you know, what has made us a great country. But we've moved away from that. That's the problem. I mean, you know, we've moved away from the kind of long-term thinking and that you need. I mean, we have really, you know, one of the theses of the book is that we've gravitated from a military-industrial complex. Yeah. And, yeah, that's a dangerous kind of thing. That's what Eisenhower referred to in his farewell speech. But still, that was an era that has produced almost all our technology. Came out of that military-industrial complex. These colliders that gave birth to the Higgs particle, to the transistor, to the laser, to superconductivity, to the computer, everything, to the internet. I mean, everything came forth from this collaboration between the government and industry. Bell Labs was, you know, one of the focal points. The lab, a comparable lab out in the West Coast, was another focal point. And, you know, these companies, Bell Labs was basically a private company. I mean, you know, was a regulated utility, like AT. It was part of AT&T, which was a regulated utility then. But, you know, people came and they wanted to do things for the future. And the government really did help a lot. I mean, one reason, you know, transistors became so small and Moore's Law became so popular is that the government kept ordering massive amounts of this equipment. And you know, that allowed people to, you know, learn how to make them smaller and, you know, learn how to improve production techniques, et cetera. It was a marvelous collaboration, and it had a long-term focus. Government was working with private industry in terms of investing. And, you know, we basically through the early 70s, I mean, I don't think there's ever been a country that's been as good as America. But, you know, we lost it. We lost it basically because we lost all sense of discipline. And, you know, one of the points that I'm, you know, going to try and make in this book is that when we went off the gold standard, when gold no longer became necessary or never it was no longer part of our monetary discipline, if you will, then we had our cake and could eat it too. We had the world's reserve currency and no holds barred. We could do whatever we wanted. And we started spending like drunken sailors and not in a productive way.
I'm sorry, Peter Schiff really is on board with you on this topic in particular. He has just pounded the table on this show for almost a decade that essentially we have, and I don't like to use this term, but we've made servants out of much of the lesser industrialized world. Future generations are not likely to look so positively on that fact, and we can't continue in such a state of servitude. We can't continue to benefit on the sweat and the labor of the world without some type of, you know, serious repercussions.
And you can't just have, you know, all this money that the Fed is printing, it's one thing that if it went to, you know, if we had printed a lot of money and bought out these mortgages, great. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know whether you say great.
I actually suggested in my dusty tome, Wealth Building Strategies 2010, that was precisely what could have, I'm not so presumptuous as to say should, instead of taking over $1 trillion, well over $1 trillion now, and throwing it at the banks, which really did nothing for anyone other than stabilize a few financial stocks, they could have set up a fund which helped those who truly had need and were were working and trying to get themselves out of the mire, avoided much of the housing mess that we ran into, subprime fiasco, Alt-A fiasco at all. Those funds that weren't used could have easily earned a tremendous return, and yes, many financial institutions might have failed. Less like Greece and more like Iceland, which has now completely come out of the financial crisis, and they're having a renaissance of their own.
They are. They are having a renaissance. Yes, we could have done a lot more. But see, what we've done is we've too much gravitated toward, you know, from this military-industrial thing complex into kind of a legal financial complex where everything is, you know, runs through lawyers, regulations, et cetera, investment bankers, et cetera. There's no there. I mean, that's basically a relatively small group there. I mean, the lawyers no longer tell the truth. I mean, people know that. They make jokes all the time about it. I mean, and that's where all the money is gone. Workers are really getting the short end of it in this country, and I think that that's terrible. And, you know, I can't believe that someone who's been a liberal most of his life, you know, finds himself saying that the Koch brothers, you know, I think have a real good point when they're saying that, you know, these bankers are just being given way too much money and that, you know, it's creating these massive inequalities in the country.
Well, see, you're preaching to the organist now, because when I hear your thoughts here, you know, and this, I hate to use a provincial metaphor like this, but it's just, I think it's appropriate. You know, the wonderful movie Company Men with just all-star cast, Ben Affleck, Tommy Lee Jones, Coach, I forget his name, another wonderful actor, and Chris Cooper and a few other big, big names. The character of Tommy Lee Jones was making the exact case you were making right here. You know, what are we doing? We've created these corporations that used to build ships and factories and cars and build real products and real wealth and industrial might.
This is true. This is very, very true. I mean, you know, when you sit down as a, whether you're an investment banker or just a banker, you're making a loan. I mean, you're not really concerned about, you know, creating, you know, a better society. You're concerned about making a deal. And there's all the difference in the world. I mean, investment bankers, you know, the money is made on the golf course. I mean, you know, and it's made, you know, in the more complicated the deal, the more money involved and the more incentive to make the deal. And it's the same thing on Wall Street. The more trades an individual makes, the better it is for the financial institution, the more commissions. Yet, you know, if you take the word of Warren Buffett, his favorite holding period is forever. And yet we count as our GDP, you know, faster computers. Well, faster computers may not be, you know, such an improvement in GDP. And it's this kind of mentality that I think we're running, really, you know, harming this country.
Do you have any interest at all in the growing concern or at least issue of AI, artificial intelligence, robotics? You know, there's a wonderful researcher, several in this area, but one that comes to mind, Hugo de Garis from Australia, he is actually partnering right now with China, the only country to express any interest in his remarkable. I mean, I'm talking, this is an individual who has spent a lifetime kind of applying science fiction in a more realistic manner to artificial intelligence. And what he's proposing is government needs to get on board with artificial intelligence, and China is picking up the ball, and they're funding his remarkable research, and they're trying to bring about the singularity. Chinese officials are partnering with academia. Are you familiar with this at all?
A little bit, yeah. Artificial intelligence is something that interests me a lot, and I've you know, studied it, and I'm convinced that our computers in this country, I mean, we have sort of deified our computers in this country without, you know, any real reason for doing it. They're great tools. And I think we should regard them as tools, not as machines that can automatically answer every question that we have. They can't, not right now. You know, I think computers like Watson and, you know, maybe the stuff that you're talking about that the Chinese are involved in can be very, very useful. But we're not really concerned about that. We want to use our computers to make things faster, to, you know, to trade faster, to do things quicker, rather than to, you know, really solve long-term problems. And I think that if we, and it's not surprising to me that the Chinese would be on board in terms of developing AI in a way that it can be more useful. And we can be more useful. I mean, but we're not doing anything in that direction right now. I mean, I think Watson is a very, very small step to take as far as that goes.
Think about the technological marvels that we've seen emerge from the southwest of the United States over the last five or six decades. And we find out only decades later that this is now an antique. It's a relic, artifact from the past. The government was decades ahead, and now we're only beginning to see where they were in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It almost begs the question whether or not they're not 20 or 30 years ahead. And that's what Dr. DeGaris says is all that's required for that singularity moment where artificial intelligence surpasses the brightest human.
I think what you have to recognize is it's sort of a philosophical statement whether they'll surpass. I mean, obviously, in certain ways, they've already surpassed. I mean, computers are faster. But the question is, you know, in what way should we use computers that can best benefit our society? And we're not doing that right now. I think China's doing it a much more effective job at it. And it's not really a question of speed per se. It's a question of, you know, focusing your computer on solving problems that, you know, human beings basically create. I mean, ultimately, I don't necessarily believe you're going to have a singularity. I mean, I don't know. I don't disbelieve it. I don't believe it. I think it's almost like a religious statement.
I was completely on that page as well until this very recent breakthrough that I just happened to come across. And apparently, researchers with a great passion for the science, artificial intelligence, have begun in the recent years to develop models, first in computers and now outside, externally, exogenously, if you will, a learning process. And I believe you're a father. You have children. The amazing thing, I think, to observe as a parent, or even those who have cats and dogs, and whatnot, this process of trial and error 1,000 times a day, over hour after hour, day after day, what appears to be happening is by having accelerated trial and error in just a handful of robots, those memories become uploadable. And suddenly, instead of having to go through 20 years of trial and error so that we develop these wonderful ambidextrous capabilities, things that we take for granted, bipedal, this can become just like, and I hate to use this again, another metaphor, but Neo on the Matrix, where you just upload these memories and suddenly robots have the ability of nearly a human being simply through prior generations having experienced that trial and error at an accelerated pace.
There's no doubt you can create computers and robots, et cetera, that to some extent can learn. And maybe on a elementary level, you might even say are conscious. I mean, animals are conscious. Dogs are conscious. Their behavior is conscious. I think the question that, you know, philosophers would argue, and I tend to, you know, basically side with the issue, notion that there's a big difference between being conscious of something and being self-aware. You know, it's the old thing where, you know, these chess computers play great chess, but Kasparov did not really get beaten.
After having watched a lot of footage, and not just the documentary everyone's seen, I am of the belief that the team may have pulled a few strings.
I mean, I know a lot about this, but Joel Benjamin, he changed the programming, and, you know, it really freaked Kasparov out. And, you know, look, computers don't have to go to the bathroom. They don't need water. They never get nervous, et cetera. I think that if you handicap, I don't want to get too far into this because I do like chess a lot, and I have studied this a lot. But in terms of chess, I do know something about it, and chess computers. In fact, I have a couple of them. Point is that, you know, still today, and this is like, when was that match with Deep or Blue played? About in the late 80s, I think, or... Yeah, even today, with these engines being faster and better, et cetera, you still find examples of mini game. In fact, I actually know Kasparov, and I gave him a copy of this game that this fellow Karana played against somebody else, and he was two moves ahead of the computer. You know, that doesn't always happen, but I mean, it did happen in this particular game. The computer had the game as a draw. Karana made a move that the computer did not consider to be one of the top four or five moves, and it gave Karana's opponent an edge. The move after that, Karana was winning the game according to the computer, and he did go ahead and win. So, I mean, you know, even today, with all the progress that supposedly has taken place over the last 20 years in computer speeds and in programming, et cetera, there are so many examples of humans really playing, right up to the strength of the computer. And, you know, part of it is that, you know, this lack of intuition that a computer has, doesn't have. And part of it is that, you know, whatever a computer is doing, they're doing it because we've put that in them.
Are you aware that you're echoing the sentiments of the well-known logician, Dr. Kurt Gödel? You know what Einstein said about Gödel? I came to Princeton University merely to have the privilege of walking home and discussing topics.
Could be. And Gödel did contribute. He did work out some
incompleteness
scenarios related to Einstein's relativity, general relativity theory, one in which, you know, basically time circles around and everything repeats. But yes, Gödel was an absolute genius. And he was, a Platonist. He did believe that there were ideals out there and that, you know, you really and could not, you know, recreate something like human awareness. And, you know, his great discovery that, you know, mathematics or arithmetic is not complete. I mean, there are things that you just cannot do. There are problems that you just cannot solve, even though you know they're true. I mean, this is something that it's very hard to, you know, connect the dots if you believe everything came out of evolution. I mean, you know, math was there as kind of as something that, you know, existed. And it wasn't something that, you know, we invented. It was something that we discovered. And I think that that really is the critical distinction between inventing something and discovering something. And, you know, that's what makes it a little bit hard to believe that, you know, computers will totally surpass humans. I think there will always be, you know, some creative spark that computers will probably lack, at least, you know, for sure in my lifetime, and I would hazard a guess probably for the next 100, 200, 300, 400 years. I think we're a long way from creating, you know, the so-called singularity. Though there's a very interesting show on one of the channels now, I can't remember which, called Humans, if you're interested in that.
It's a British, a sitcom very, almost.
Yeah, it's a good show, though, right? I mean, don't you like
it? Oh, it's remarkable.
Yeah, that's fine. No, I think that these are not questions that, you know, we're going to settle. These are, you know, philosophers like Nagel, for instance, just wrote this book about, or I guess last year, a year and a half ago, that, you know, you just cannot see accounting for human awareness through Darwinian evolution. You just cannot see it happening. And I tend to agree. I mean, I do, but a lot of people vehemently disagree. So, you know, like I said, these kinds of things become almost religious-type arguments.
Well, and there's good reason for that, because, I mean, I think it's clear that Gödel did such a phenomenal job at showing that no system, whether it be mathematical, physics-related, logic, no system is completely self-contained. It is incomplete, and he proves it. I mean,
Well, he does, yes. That was quite something. He and Turing also, you know, had a role in that. Yeah, and that's what sort of makes you believe that there are things out there that were always out there, that are not created through evolution, that you have to discover but are not invented.
Well, I think it's a great distinction you make, and I know the key takeaway that Gödel would obviously say, look, in order for there to be that divine spark, it's something beyond us. It's beyond this beyond the set theory, and we have that. We have the divine spark, whereas the artificial intelligence, where is that going to originate from, what area?
Well, I think artificial intelligence, you know, depending on what you mean by it, because it can have a wide range of meanings, can be very useful. I mean, if you try and use computers in a way that you're directing their use, it becomes very good. But if you try and use computers as something that can just create a solution for you, like they do when this combinatorial chemistry, where they try every possible combination or trying every possible combination of different genes, you're not going to get very far, because you know what? The power of even the fastest computers cannot come even close to dealing with all the different kinds of combinations that, you know, our brains deal with. I mean, what do we have, like 100 billion neurons? I mean, the number of combinations in our brain for things, the number of different ways approaches the number of elementary particles in the universe. Yes, yes. Use of every single bit of that, but it means that, you know, the calculating power of our brains is not as fast as a computer, but it's much, much, much water. And I don't think you can create a computer or imagine a computer that could match the capacity of our brains in certain respects, okay? It, obviously, in terms of speed, yes, easily. But in terms of how broad and how totally connected everything is to everything else, no, I think our brains will always have an advantage over computers as we understand computers today.
You know, I'm kind of on the fence. Right now, I think Moore's Law has been handicapped a bit. I think you'd agree. It's finally gotten a bit capped by the limits of silicon. We will eclipse that threshold as new technologies.
I think that the best shot, and, you know, that we would have, and what would give me pause, no, it's not, you know, keeping up with Moore's Law. We're not going to do that. Okay. I mean, but I think that, you know, when you talk about quantum computing, I mean, but even there, you know, unfortunately, there are going to be certain problems that quantum computers are going to be able to deal with and deal with much on a much quicker level than the computers that we have today, like factoring very large numbers, et cetera, like sorting things. But in terms, again, you know, making links between disparate objects, I just don't think that you're going to be able to do it with computers.
Oh, see, now you're bringing up another topic, and you didn't even mean to. P versus NP.
But in the meantime, coming back to where we were at the beginning, you know, I think we have to get religion in this country, and not necessarily, you know, Judaism or Christianity or Islam or anything else. I think we have to get the kind of long-term thinking that got us here in the first place. I think we have to return to that and return to, you know, respecting one another. I mean, which is what we don't see in Washington. And in, we have to get away from all the bickering and fighting. And we have to, you know, sort of believe in ourselves again. I mean, you know, again, I think America from the 40s, the mid to late 40s onward to the, you know, early to mid 70s was the greatest country this planet's ever seen. And, you know, I think we have to get back to the ideals that made that possible. And I still believe that is possible. And I think that, you know, dealing with China on a even basis and not trying to put them down or to disparage them, I think would be, you know, a real good step in the right direction, trying to make friends, create things, because, you know, we've shown the ability and remarkable ability to create so much. I mean, the world owes us for the internet, for the transit. Like I said before, almost any, you know, modern day technology was born in this country in, you know, the 50s and 60s. It's remarkable. It was. And we just haven't delivered the full benefits of that. We sort of have gotten lost because I think, you know, well, Peter Schiff says it. I mean, whatever. We've gotten lost in this kind of financial legal morass that we're living in today that just doesn't allow us to do a lot of different things.
And I hope that folks will look at methods and methodologies and wisdom and traditions that could give us a more harmonious relationship with our competitors around the world, because it is doable.
Someone who wrote in the latter part of the 20th century was this guy, E.F. Schumacher. And he had a lot of very, very good things to say. And I would certainly recommend, you know, two of his books, Small is Beautiful, and also A Guide for the Perplexed, as being, you know, really, really good books to read. And they really make you think. And, you know, he wasn't a liberal, a conservative, a Republican, a Democrat. He was just somebody looking for ways in which, you know, human beings can live together and live with a lot of, you know, peace of mind and a lot of self-esteem, et cetera. And it, you know, it's works. I think it is possible in ways to use technology to our advantage.
But if I could just wrap up this thought with one bit of wisdom here gleaned from Albert Einstein. Later in his life, he became a vegetarian. Yeah, this is a path I've chosen over a year now. As he progressed down that path, he said the number one thing, and I'm paraphrasing here, that any culture, any society could do to avoid strife and friction and conflict is to embrace vegetarianism. Gandhi also echoes these sentiments, I think, so well when he points out that the measure of a society boils down to the way in which it treats its animals.
In a sense, yeah, I've never really thought about that, but I think they're, you know, and I'm not a vegetarian, but it does make you know, again, Schumacher, you know, identifies four different categories that exist in this world. The inanimate, not alive, rocks, etc., plants, animals, and then humans. And animals are, you know, among the conscious creatures. I mean, we're conscious and self-aware. Animals are conscious. And, you know, there is some sense to saying, you know, why are we killing and destroying conscious creatures?
Having listened to many, many gurus in this area, Buddhist and Hindu, as well as read many of the texts along the way, I don't think you even have to follow just Eastern cultures. I mean, you can look at some of the greats in our society. I mean, the founder of the London School of Economics made it clear, I don't eat my friends. Another great thinker in this culture pointed out, I will refuse to eat anything with eyes or a nervous system. Srinivasa Ramanujan, greatest mind in the last 100 years, never touched any meat his entire life, was a strict vegetarian. Just another example, and in his mind transcended mathematics in a way that very few mathematicians today can even grasp.
I think you make very, very good points here, Chris. When you look at something like gold, okay, and you compare it to the dollar, you're comparing something that has been used for money for probably 4,000 or 5,000 years. And you're comparing that with something that has been used as money for maybe 250 years. So there's really something kind of platonic about gold. There, you know, and it has a lot of characteristics that make it very, very special. I mean, it doesn't oxidize. It stays shiny. I mean, almost all the gold that's ever been mined is still in existence. So there is something very special about gold. I'm not saying it's, you know, God created it or anything like that, but it is something platonic about it. You know, it's just, it wasn't invented, it was discovered. The dollar was something that was invented. Let me put that, let me make that distinction, like we were talking about before with Gödel, arguing that the fact that, you know, no system could be can be complete. That was something discovered, not invented. The dollar was invented. Paper money was invented. Gold was not invented. It was there. And it was there with all these magical, you know, almost magical properties. I don't want to say magical because, you know, it means something else. But it, properties where it can be stretched. It can be, you know, you can do a lot with gold. I mean, it maintains its shine and it's almost impossible to destroy. That in itself, in the right context, when things go bad, and when a monetary system starts breaking down, and when you have these massive inequalities, as you do in this country, and you've printed trillions of dollars, et cetera, you might want to return to something where you've seen the economy work better when it becomes a part of the monetary system. I'm not saying a strict gold standard. I mean, you know, by no means, but a role for gold makes a lot of sense. It really does. I mean, you know, it's been a part of our civilizations, again, for, you know, many, many thousands of years, probably from 2000 BC on. I don't know. But it's always been there. And I think that there has to be a role for it. I mean, it's the disciplinarian in our world, and it can be very, very useful in that role if we, you know, again, use it in the proper way and don't get too carried away and allow flexibility, et cetera. But, you know, I just think it's inevitable that it's going to come back, and it's inevitable that the dollar is going to lose its role as, you know, the world's reserve currency. And I think you're going to have something in which gold has at least a partial role to play. And, you know, that's one reason China figures so prominently, because they obviously believe this. I mean, they've been buying gold, and so is India, and so is the entire eastern part of the world. And you're seeing this massive shift, and I think that unless we wake up, you know, we could get caught holding the bag. You know, their currencies could, you know, become much, much more valuable than our currencies. And, you know, that would just give them an edge in every which way. So I'm not trying to, you know, end this by sounding pessimistic, but I am trying to end it by saying we've got to give up on this complacency that we have, and we've got to return to those things that have served us so well in the past. And, you know, one of them, a monetary system that in which gold at least had a role to play.
I don't think it's pessimistic at all. I think it sounds optimistic to gold aficionados. So it's just music to all of our ears. Dr. Stephen Leib, can you tell us more about when we can expect your latest magnum opus and any other contact information?
You know, as I'm sitting here talking to you, Chris, my wife is, you know, working on actually, you know, really a very detailed outline. And I would hope, you know, that we're done with it in time for the bull market. I mean, I hope we don't, but I probably will miss a little bit of the bull market in gold. But once it starts, and just, it's not going to start with an entire monetary system planned out, because I'm not that smart. I can't see exactly how gold is going to work in a world in which you have East divided from West right now, et cetera. It's going to be complicated. But the trigger point will be the point at which individuals, the markets, if you will, start to recognize that the dollar's role as a dominant currency in the world is coming to an end. Now, for whatever reason, I mean, doesn't mean that it's going to come to an end at that moment, but when they realize the inevitability of the dollar's role coming to an end, then you'll see the bull market in gold starting in earnest. And, you know, how high it goes, I think it's going to surprise everybody. I mean, it's going to be remarkably high. And I think that everybody, even those that don't invest in the stock market, you know, you should then buy a gold coin. Or if you can't afford a gold coin, buy a silver coin. You should have some gold or gold correlates as part of your wealth distribution. I mean, I just really think it's essential. I really believe that. And, you know, I think that's not a bad place to leave.
Pearls of wisdom from the East Coast.
This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed this, okay? I really did. And have a great day, Chris. Thanks a lot.
Well, so glad you're back with us at GoldSeek.com Radio for today's Gold Nugget segment with John Williams of Shadow Stats. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome John Williams, head of ShadowStats.com, an alternative economic resource. It's a pleasure to have you back on the show. Welcome back, John.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris.
We have a bevy of topicality to choose from. For instance, we find out that entering a really interesting time in global currencies with China intervening not only in its currency market this week, but as well as its equities market. Then we see surprising volatility coming into the Western world financial markets. Give us an idea of maybe an overview of what you see happening here.
Well, there are several major distortions affecting the system. Number one is the U.S. dollar, and it's, heavily overvalued. And as you see the dollar sell off, and I think we will have that in the not-too-distant future, but it's very difficult to time. But I think we'll eventually face a massive dollar decline, and that will have all sorts of effects in the system, ranging from a spike in oil prices to general debasement in the dollar, much higher gold and silver prices. When I say the dollar is overvalued, there are several reasons behind that. But number one is probably the weakness in the U.S. economy, which is not fully recognized, although a lot of the underlying economic weakness is continually surfacing here. I mean, if you look at what people are expecting in the economy now versus what they were looking at the beginning of the year or last year, it's much weaker. I'll contend that we're actually in a recession, a new recession. I mean, if you want to get into the background detail, I'll contend that we never really recovered from the economic collapse that took place from 2007 into 2008, 2009.
I think your work is the only work that I've seen that quantitatively supports that comment. I mean, if we take a look at the ShadowStats GDP numbers, we have, with very few exceptions, the GDP has remained in negative territory since the internet implosion bubble of the year 2000.
Well, there are two versions. The one you're talking about there reflects adjustments for changes that they made to the assumptions on the GDP and the things that they've added into it to help adjust it over time, or to add growth over time. Well, let's get to the GDP reporting for a moment, because that is the broadest measure of the economy that's published and one that is looked at definitively by many people. You go back over time, you'll find that the variety of changes have been made where new areas have been added to the GDP, defined into the GDP. For example, this last time around, they added in a category for intellectual property so that the value of the copyright of someone in Hollywood who makes a movie is now added into the GDP. The changes they made the last time, they figured it added about 0.3% to the annual growth rate. Well, when they make those revisions, they not only add them in, but they restate history going back in time, all the way back to 1929. What happens there is what I call Pollyanna creep, because they put in all these happy items that are going to increase the numbers now, and you look back and the numbers in the Great Depression improved because of the changes in assumptions that they're making today. And if you go back, you'll find that you get a general upgrading of growth in the GDP each time they go through a round of these gimmicks. And if you take out the gimmicks, you'll find that the economy indeed has been in a contraction since the dot-com bubble burst. But there's another area which is, allowing all the general reporting gimmicks that they've added, such as the intellectual properties, you have a basic flaw in the system in terms of how the inflation is used. The GDP, as with most economic statistics, is viewed net of inflation. The idea being that if let's say you look at retail sales. Retail sales out for July showing 0.6% monthly increase. That's before any consideration for inflation. And you really need to take out the increase in prices over the last year to see how the physical volume of retail sales is going. Well, although the headline inflation numbers are understated by at least several percentage points, 3 to 7%, putting all that aside, given the official numbers, you're probably going to see about 0.2% increase in the CPI for July, which means that 0.6% increase was 0.4%. GDP, same thing. It's adjusted for inflation, but there are elements of the inflation there that are significantly understate inflation in terms of current numbers, about 2 percentage points. In the GDP, that's separate from the consumer price index. There are different inflation factors involved. The problem with using too low inflation and deflating an economic statistics is that the result is the inflation adjusted number, what they call real growth, is overstated. With roughly a 2 percentage point overstatement in the current GDP, what you'll see is that as the economy collapsed into the middle of 2009, which is the official trough, and then, as I show the official numbers, it just recovers from there, and by 2011, it's hit a new high versus where it was before the recession, and is now maybe about 8% above, 9% above the pre-recession peak. But if you correct for this the understated inflation, what you see is that the economy plunged into 2009, and then instead of recovering, just has been bottom bouncing at a low level of stagnation. And you see that pattern in other series, and I'll contend that that's a reality. So that as the economy is now turning down again, you'll see that the what will eventually gain recognition as a new recession is really still part of the economic collapse that we went through back in 2008 and 2009.
If we do return to those levels, well, it would certainly be quite a shock to the system. How would you expect our officials to respond?
Well, they're not going to they're not going to recognize that it's been as weak as I've shown, because they're not going to change the inflation reporting. Every year they revise the GDP numbers. With that, aside from the gimmicks that they've added in, they tend to have upside positive assumptions built into most of their statistics. Then they'll benchmark them a year or two later, and the benchmarks almost always are negative because they're benchmarking against solid numbers or at least more accurate data. And we just went through a GDP benchmark revision that knocked down the growth in 2012 and 2013. Once you get into the era where they don't have new and better numbers, they still have all their positive assumptions in it, and it picks up. But right now, 2012 looks like we had a no growth, probably a recession, as it would be formally viewed eventually, the last half of 2012. 2011 never really got revised. And the reason that didn't happen was because of the government shutdown in 2013. That delayed the reporting of some of the numbers that got into the most recent benchmarking. But in the most recent benchmarking, they started the benchmarking in 2012, not 2011. If they had done 2011, you would have seen a recession in 2011, much weaker growth. And so what we're beginning to see here, and they're not going to revise the 2011 numbers now until 2018 when they go into one of those grand scale revisions and add in all new modeling like the intellectual properties. That's when they tend to make those changes. But what we'll be seeing at that point in time is that the economic recovery has really been, although their numbers will show some uptrend because they're not adjusting for the inflation, that there have really been multiple dips. Sort of multiple dip economic collapse. And in terms of where we are right now, I mean, some of the better statistics are showing outright recession, industrial production. That used to be the recession. That used to be the GDP measure. It's contracted in both the first and the second quarter of this year, quarter to quarter. Normally, two GDP contractions would be considered a recession. That did not come out of the benchmark revision. I thought it might, but the that doesn't mean it isn't a recession. My goodness, the severe downturn that we had that started at the end of 2007 wasn't recognized as a recession until the end of 2008. Here we had another downturn that started the end of 2014. It'll get recognized probably by the end of the year. But industrial production is contracted quarter to quarter. Annual growth of the retail sales, the first quarter retail sales contracted. Those types of growth patterns are not seen outside of recessions or immediately preceding a recession. You look at the S&P 500. That's a fairly broad indicator of corporate America. Domestic economic activity when you look at the sales, the revenues. What you've seen is the revenues have contracted first quarter and second quarter, both quarters, so far in 2015. Again, that doesn't happen outside of recession. Last time you saw that was during the economic collapse. Same thing with those retail sales and industrial production numbers. The economy is turning down. That's with the reasonably good quality numbers. The not so hot numbers, such as the housing statistics, are going to catch up and catch up with that as well. But my reason for mentioning all of this is that underlying the strength in the U.S. dollar has been generally a presumption that the U.S. economy is recovering and it's growing, and not only growing but growing strongly enough to enable the Fed to start raising interest rates again. And that has been a big factor behind the strength in the dollar. Aside from relative economic strength or perceptions of same, relative interest rates are very, very important in terms of the currency's strength. So that what happens as the economic statistics weaken is that the perceptions begin to wane that the Fed's going to raise those interest rates. That's what happened yesterday with the Chinese devaluation, that there's an expectation there that maybe the Fed's not going to be raising rates and the dollar weakened. It's going to get a lot weaker as economic statistics surprise the markets. And that's where you start to see some of the big changes in the underlying markets, commodities and such. That's where you see the debasement of the dollar, and eventually you'll be seeing higher inflation. And the reason oil prices are headed back down again is because the dollar strengthened. But you look at what happened yesterday as the dollar was weakening, oil prices and gold and silver prices rose. The strength we've seen in the dollar in the last year is an absolute canard. If you look at the what changed, where all of a sudden the dollar, which is was not too far off its historic low, that everyone would want to flee to it. Well, there are some issues in terms of some liquidity problems in the euro area, which I'll get back to. But primarily, what happened was the Russians were doing things with Ukraine that the United States didn't like, and the U.S. imposed financial sanctions at the end of June against leaders there. But it's also fairly obvious that there was some covert action, because within a day or two of the headline actions against the officials, the oil price began to plunge. And along with that, you were seeing a big rally in the dollar. My contention is that was largely manipulated as a way of putting financial stress on the Russians. And that, as that began to unfold, people were looking for reasons for the dollar to rally. Oh, strong economy's recovering. Well, if you go back then, we had booming growth, 4 or 5% annualized GDP. That's nonsense. And that'll become obvious in the next, probably the next benchmark revision. But it wasn't that far back in time that they'd get it this time around. But there were all sorts of manipulations that were done. I think the Fed really needs to raise interest rates. It's not a healthy circumstance. But the the strange thing here, or the perverse thing here, they never lowered the rates to stimulate the economy. You go back to the panic of 2008. The federal government could not allow the financial system to collapse, and indeed was on the brink of collapse. I kid you not, no one in Washington was kidding about that. We were at the brink of systemic collapse. So the federal government did everything that they had to do, spent whatever money they lent, whatever money they guaranteed, whatever had to be guaranteed, prevented collapse in the system. But all the things they did just bought them a little time. They didn't do anything to solve the underlying problems. They didn't do anything to address the economy. They didn't do much to address the banking system solvency. They certainly did nothing to address the long-term solvency, sovereign solvency concerns that the rest of the world had with the United States and their tremendous budget deficit when they look at it using gap accounting and unfunded liabilities. None of that was addressed. And then we had the Fed, in order to provide liquidity to the system. You have to keep in mind that despite the Fed always mentioned, oh, we have a congressional mandate to make sure there's adequate economic growth and contained inflation, that they have, but their primary responsibility is to keep the banking system afloat. If the banking system collapses, the rest of it doesn't make too much difference, because you're not going to have an ongoing happy economic system. So that what they did with their quantitative easing was basically aimed at supporting the banking system. But as that became increasingly unpopular politically, they used the weakness in the economy as political cover for what they did, saying, oh, we're doing this to stimulate the economy. You get that now going back and forth. It's sort of like Janet Yellen and her people are playing a bad cop, good cop with the markets. And it's, oh, the economy's too weak, or, you know, it's the economy strengthening and strong economy, we're going to raise rates, weak economy, we're going to keep them low. If they wanted to raise rates, they could do so, and it wouldn't make too much difference at this point because the stock market and the currency markets are already anticipating that. I don't think they're going to actually do that, though. I don't think they're going to raise the rates because the economy is going to be getting worse, not better, in the months ahead. And as that happens, the markets are the markets will basically write off a Fed raising rates. But as the rest of the world looks at it, that's relative weakness for the dollar, and you're going to see a movement out of the dollar, massive move from the dollar. The situation in Greece that has helped to hurt the euro relative to the dollar, or there maybe have been some flight to the dollar there, is, I mean, there's some legitimate currency movements there. But the problem is the United States really is not much better than and much better basic a financial condition than Greece. When you look at the way we've handled our the federal commitments to the money it's going to spend in the future and our ongoing deficits, that's a big problem. And people say, oh, it's not going to have that much effect on the dollar. Well, what they forget is that back in 2011, when Standard & Poor's downgraded the credit rating of the U.S. Treasuries, we had a currency panic. The dollar was in a massive sell-off, and all of a sudden there was all sorts of jawboning and intervention. The jawboning was basically aimed at saying, there's nothing wrong with the United States, the problem's in Europe. And a lot of focus was put against the euro. They try and knock the euro down to help prop up the dollar on a relative basis. The Swiss, at the same time, pegged their currency to the euro, and in the process helped to support the dollar, helped to prop the dollar. Now, the problem with intervention is that if the markets are going against you, and that's generally why you intervene, it becomes very expensive to move the markets the way you want. The Swiss had to give it up early this year. But there's another country that was looking to enter the global financial markets, currency markets, the same par with the dollar, and that's a Chinese yuan. It's effectively been pegged, but it has had a trading band around it for some time. And if you go back to when they went off a fixed rate, which was back in 2005, you look at how the currencies have done since then. The currency that has been the strongest against the dollar, it's up a third or so from, or excuse me, it's about 40%. From 2005 to date, the Swiss franc. But so is the Chinese yuan. Now they're removing their peg. It becomes very expensive. Yes, what's been happening is the artificially strong dollar, when they've been trying to keep up with the dollar, has pulled their currency higher and made them less competitive against the rest of the world, where the major currencies such as the yen, the Australian dollar, the Canadian dollar, the British pound, all have been weakening. So that I can understand why they did what they did. The problem here again is the dollar is distorting the global system, and that's what will the markets will force a correction with that, and when it does, that's when you start to see some reality turning to the commodity markets. And again, sell-off in the dollar will be reflected in much higher oil prices, much higher gold prices, much higher silver prices.
I would appreciate your thoughts, though, on the potential for higher rates. For instance, many top analysts are expecting now a September increase of a quarter point in the benchmark lending rate, as well as perhaps another quarter point increase at the December FOMC meeting. If we also read into the minutiae of some of the Fed's literature, it's clear that the Fed governors are interested in increasing rates as high as 2.5% to even 3%. At least that's what they say on paper. Do you think this is a canard? Are they bluffing?
I can believe they'd like to do that, but I think they're bluffing. I mean, they're playing games back and forth. I mean, you'll see reports like that, and then all of a sudden, one of the Fed bank presidents or board members will make a statement in the other direction. That's deliberate. Those are people manipulating the market. They don't want to see the stock market crash, and they're afraid that if interest rates go higher, that stocks will crash. They see the stock market as one of the few things that's propping up the economy. Well, it's not. The economy's in trouble. I think I'd go ahead and raise interest rates, but I don't think they have the courage to do so. And again, as I said earlier, I think at least that September rate's already priced into the stock market and the currency market. You have a problem with the low interest rate is that it kills people on fixed incomes. You can't get a safe livable return on your money with 0% interest. I mean, some people used to be able to go get 4 or 5% on a CD. Can't do that. You can't buy a treasury bill that gives you a return greater than the rate of inflation. I mean, that's nonsense. That's a horrible investment environment and discourages a lot of activity. Another factor is that with higher interest rates, the banks have greater profit margin potential. They can increase their margins, and with higher margins, they have the ability to lend to riskier accounts. And in the process, that increases lending. One thing that has not happened here is a normal growth in bank lending. That if you'd had normal growth in bank lending, you could have had something of an economic recovery. But the low rates have kept it under wraps. So I think those are reasons that they would like to see higher rates. There are others who say, the rates go higher, it's going to kill economic activity. Well, it'll tend to boost mortgage rates, although there's some pretty good margins still there. And that may have some effect, indeed, on housing demand, which isn't real strong, despite all the headline numbers. But for businesses, high rates are not a detriment, usually, in terms of activity. All they do is build the cost into their product. It tends to be somewhat inflationary. But on balance, I think the economy would be doing better with higher inflation than no inflation. But again, from the Fed standpoint, they're afraid of what's going to happen to the stock market. They've created this really phony debate about, my goodness, if the economy gets better, then we can raise rates. So that's how they build expectations. And that's become a driving factor in the financial markets. I don't think they've got maybe wrong on this, but I don't think they've got the courage to go against that, particularly as the economy should be turning down the next month or so before the next FOMC meeting. And with that, the Fed's been under a lot of criticism in Congress. You're coming into an election year, you get some congressmen questioning the Fed chairman about how can you raise interest rates as the economy is heading into a new recession. It's a question she can't answer honestly. But in sum and substance, my bet would be they don't raise the rates. But even if they do, at least that first one's discounted.
As we wrap up here today, John, tell folks more about the services you provide at shadowstats.com, what they can find, and any other contact information that might be handy.
Sure. Well, the best bet's just to go to our website, which indeed is shadowstats.com. On the homepage, right-hand column, top of that column, you'll see a series of articles that describe where I think we are, why I think where we are, and where things are headed. Because as the dollar, once we get a massive decline in the dollar, we're then going to be looking at a much higher inflation circumstance, one that I believe will roll into a hyperinflationary environment. That's there for the looking at. I have alternate measures on inflation, on unemployment, where I've worked out estimates based on the way numbers used to be reported and why the let me put it this way. I find very commonly that most people think the economy is weaker than is being reported, and that inflation is stronger than is being reported. And in terms of common experience, they're right. The reason it's that way is because the government's changed its methodologies over time, basically to put in stuff that spiked economic numbers and depress inflation. So I have estimates of the CPI and unemployment there on the again for public viewing as to where it would be if the government had not made all its changes in methodology. And I do have a weekly newsletter, which if people are interested in, they can subscribe to that and see the headlines on that in the left-hand column. And you usually get out a couple of newsletters a week, depending upon the economic data being released. Always welcome new subscribers, but there's a lot of material there for non-subscribers to get a sense of what's going on.
John Williams of ShadowStats, what a wealth of information. Look forward to talking to you soon.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. There has been and continues to be much discussion and speculation about the real amount of Chinese gold holdings. Last month, China reported a 57% increase in its holdings to 1,658 tons, which was believed and calculated by many to be a real lowball number. With many in the gold community, including some mainstream media, thinking 3,500 tons was more like it, up to more than 10,000 tons. Then last week it was announced that the decision to include the yuan in the IMF's special drawing rights was going to be delayed by 9 months. Some have suggested this will cause war. Saber-rattling and the threat of war is something we must always be prepared for and prepared to win. I believe the 9 extra months in this case is more realistically a very public step in a global negotiating process that will extract maximum value for all participants and the ultimate inclusion of the Chinese currency into the IMF's special drawing rights. But concurrently and quietly, with any perceived saber-rattling, China has once again come out this week and updated its gold holdings for the second time in the past month, indicating it bought 19 tons of gold last month as prices reached their lowest levels in 5 years. Officially, China increased its holdings 1% last month to 1,677 tons of gold, and thereby officially sanctioned this level as the official amount of gold that they hold. Regardless of the fact that there may be several thousand tons more gold, or even more in an off-ledger depository, this is the official reality the world will proceed with going forward, at least for now. According to this official reality, China is now the 6th largest holder of gold in the world, after the U.S., Germany, the IMF, Italy, and France, according to the World Gold Council. And of course, the U.S. maintains its gold reserves at 8,133 tons, and that those haven't changed in decades. Going forward, we're going to start hearing on a monthly basis how much China has increased its gold holdings from this current baseline of 1,677 tons. It's called the IMF's Special Data Dissemination Standard, or SDDS for short, which was launched in 1996 and is used by more than 70 countries now for monthly reporting of gold holdings. However, the secret numbers this reporting standard will never reveal is how much gold China is truly starting out with, and how much gold the U.S. actually has left. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. And if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers for their companies or professional organizations, please visit my companion site at robertian.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.